Thanks for jumping on today. I appreciate it. I know you're super busy.
I'm sure you are too, man.
Just doing this. That's all I do. You probably have something cool planned.
No, today is like, what is it? It's that December time of year where it's like, you kind of like planning next year and meeting with companies and doing that kind of stuff, which I, you know, it's fine. And I'm going, I'm headed out to Texas tomorrow to do some deer hunting before the holidays, get here and packing and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. You get to go down there and go hunt whitetail.
Yeah. We're going to, I think they're going to be rutting pretty good when I get there. And then, there'll be, you know, like Texas is better weather than North Idaho and Eastern Washington. So I'm looking forward to that. And, I kind of missed the rut this year. I didn't hunt whitetails like I normally do very hard. Just kind of, honestly, I was out of time. I burned all my time in September. So I kind of stayed close to home this year, missed the whitetail rut and turned all my tags in for Washington because I left Washington as a resident. And to speed up that process of becoming an Idaho resident and buying your tags, you got to have a certain amount of time. So turned my whitetail tag in. And missed my first whitetail. I haven't missed a whitetail season in Washington since, I don't know, since I was 18.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's crazy.
Do you do any whitetail hunting?
No, man. It's, I've been to Wisconsin one time. So I went back and, the guys at Matthews there had me back for a week and went back and got to walk around the factory and do a full tour. And then, one of the guys there, Ben, had me out. He has like a little bit of a family farm. I think it's his in-laws' place, a couple hundred acres. And so I sat stand for probably 4 or 5 days and I shot. It might have been a two-year-old. It was the only buck I saw. In fact, it was like, I think I saw 3 deer in 4 days, like dark to dark sits, you know, just all day, cold in the tree. So it was kind of hit or miss. But yeah, this buck walked in one morning, just gray light. I mean, I had no idea what he was, but yeah, just dropped him off and dumped him, and he's sitting here on my desk. In fact, the other day I had some guys over and they were just looking through the different heads and stuff on my desk, and he picks the one up and he's like, man, that looks like a pretty good coos deer. And I was like, well, it would be if it was a coos deer, but that's that's a full-on Eastern whitetail. So but I want to do more of it. I don't know if it's just like the older I get, but I have like a real fascination with whitetail hunting. And I think, I don't know if you follow along with like the Seek One guys, but their whole shtick, everything that they've got going on, I think is so fascinating. Like hunting these urban interface, you know, giant whitetail. And I think that niche is super cool. So I think it's probably something I'd like to do in the future if I can.
Yeah. I got to meet those guys, last summer, Vortex had a kind of like a, what I think they called it an ambassador summit or something, but those guys were there and I got to meet them. They're the real deal. Yeah. And if you've ever knocked on a door, oh, I hate it. I absolutely hate it. I hate it. And I have a lot of respect for door-to-door salesmen, especially any that come to my house. I'm such a jerk to them because I just hate being bothered and I hate bothering people.
Yeah.
And asking for permission. But that Lee kid, if he was ever in sales, door-to-door sales, dude, he would crush it. He's so personable and systematic. And then he even has documentation that they can fill out so that like he had, I mean, when you kill bucks of that caliber, people are going to be checking if you dotted I's, crossed T's. And
yeah.
It's a lot of skill.
For sure.
Oh, man. I was really, yeah, I watched his latest film and it was a long one. And so I wasn't able to consume it. I don't consume a lot of media. Mm-hmm. And I watched it over a weekend. I was, you know, I have kids too and interrupted in soccer games. So I didn't get to watch it straight through, but I really liked it. I really enjoyed that, that Ohio deer he killed. And I think they did a pretty good job of documenting like the amount of work. I'm like, this guy cannot be married or have kids to do what he does. But a lot of respect for his hustle. I mean, you got to respect the guy's hustle.
For sure. Yeah. I think they have one of the most interesting niches in hunting going. I think that there's these different, you know, content channels or people that kind of find something that works for them or something that they like to do that I think is super interesting. And I think as far as what's going on right now, I think what he has is really cool. I just like finding these urban legend, you know, like the interface, kind of these overlooked areas, and then just the hustle that's required to make that come together. And I just think it's super interesting. I'm sure whitetail hunters find it intriguing and interesting as well, but like from a Westerner looking east, I think it's really cool what he's got going on. But yeah, I gotta get more into whitetail hunting. Just can't hunt elk all the time. They only bugle for, you know, a few weeks, so gotta figure something else out.
Yeah, there was a shift in my game this year where when I did go whitetail hunting, I had the saddle system, mm-hmm. and I didn't know it was pretty bad until I made a video about it. Yeah. And I read the comments and I was like, okay, I need to step up my game, which I have recently. But I was running, you know, some pretty good stuff, but my climbing sticks were heavy and sure. quite dangerous, to be honest with you. But man, I went mobile whitetail hunting on public land and I absolutely loved it. And I immediately was like, cause I've hunted elk out of tree stands here and there, but this is like hiking in ladders and hiking in a platform, several trips. Then you got to take it with you. And, you know, this was the first year I kind of finally found a really good spot for it with a considerable amount of effort. I had to drive a long ways in the off season, get it set up, put some cameras out, try to figure out their travel corridor, and just put my whitetail hat on really. And mm-hmm. I sat the stand, I passed on a few elk. I got busted drawing on a 6-point, and it really was my own mistake. The felt came off my Q80 MX2 when I hiked through the brush. I've never had that happen. And when I drew back, it went,
yeah.
And I was as shocked as the 6-point bull when that sound. And so he took off and I let down and I actually started laughing because I wanted to cry because I'd literally hunted my ass off. But the point was I loved being elevated and I loved like passing on a few elk. Probably should have shot one that I passed on. But the whitetail hunting this year was like, okay, I'm no longer hiking it. I'm going to start saddle hunting for elk, like legitimate. Gonna make that a thing out west, and I think others could do it. I've always made fun of like any Easterner or Midwest guys that come over, and I see them, you know, I see their license plate, and they're talking about putting a tree stand up in Colorado over the counter unit on a wallow. And I always just picture them on one wallow, and then there's probably 30 wallows all the way up the mountain. And I just like, that's wasting your time. But I've definitely found pinch points, funnels, water sources, natural mineral licks where, man, if you just punched the clock 2 to 4 hours a day, every day of your hunt, I think you would probably maybe up your odds and it's productive. And so I'm all about being productive when I'm in the field. And so I think I have this new system from Latitude Outdoors. It weighs nothing. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to employ that periodically during my elk season, just to kind of like, I'm always trying to evolve. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that might be the way that I'm going to do that next year.
Yeah. There's certain times of September, like if they're just not talking. I remember I hunted a drainage with Neville that used to work here in Wyoming, and there was only one water source in the top end of this drainage, but the whole drainage was full of elk, both sides of the canyon. And we hunted, you know, chased those things all over, up and down the canyon, called back and forth. And we went 4 or 5 days trying to do it. And then we ended up finding, following this bull to a water hole. He was basically wallowing in this giant water hole. And, I just was like, let's set up on this wallow. I shot a bull. He shot a bull. His brother went back the next year, shot a bull. There's just like certain places where it's just like, man, it just makes sense. Like if you can find one of those where it's just going to get hit. And just like you said, you punch the clock day in and day out, you'll end up shooting a bull. It's just a matter of time and getting the wind right.
When I first started elk hunting, I remember this was 2001, 2002. Mm-hmm. I remember being in my tent August 30th, getting out of it, and there was frost everywhere. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, or I'm not like a, but I'm just telling you, like my tinfoil hat's on. I haven't had a frosty morning till like late September for the last 5 years. Like I just think Septembers are hotter,
Yeah,
and
for
I don't
sure.
think it's my imagination, and that has made it to where like 2 to 5 p.m. I'm gonna be on a water source if I'm hunting high country, and I'm gonna be hopefully a bull's gonna come wallow or get water in that time frame versus, you know, because you're already waiting for the thermals to change, you're waiting for them to get up, and you might even be in on their bubble, but you can't be too close. You don't want to get winded, especially if a puffy cloud comes by and changes the wind. So I just like the idea of kind of sitting near a water source, 2 to 5. And man, the elk, they don't really look up like whitetails do yet.
Sure.
So yeah.
Well, that's good, man. I've been recording the whole time. Hopefully you're okay with that. I just hit record back a while ago, so we'll just get rolling.
Perfect. Perfect.
I was curious, Dan. I think I mean Elk Shape, right? So that's kind of like the title of your platform. Elk Shape. I think you got into it because you love elk hunting for one, and then I think you have this pursuit of, you know, physical fitness and nutrition and kind of your background there. So I was curious as to like what is your background? I think I've met you, I've known you, like we've had some interactions, but like I was curious as to like what's your background? What'd you grow up like? Did you grow up playing sports? Did you grow up in fitness? Like where did that love come from?
Oh yeah, thank you for pointing that out, because I don't talk about that very often, but had a great childhood, played sports.
Wrestle, basketball, football?
So mainly baseball, football.
Okay.
I did wrestle, and then I broke my ankle wrestling, I think in high school, early high school. So I hung it up and traded wrestling for snow skiing and girls.
Yeah.
But I wished I would have wrestled. I was built for it, like just body structure wise and cardio stamina. But so I've always loved wrestling. My boy wrestles. He and I make him wrestle. He's 8, and I literally treat it as go get sweaty for a couple hours. He wrestles 3 days a week for practice in Idaho. Pretty legit program. And I don't even know if he'll do a tournament this year. I don't care. I just want him to be tough and to do hard things. And yeah, raising soft kids is like the antithesis of like my philosophy. So I grew up playing sports, but my dad did a dang good job, like the best job of making hunting very sexy to me. Meaning, I remember following his footsteps grouse hunting. I remember him bringing home deer. We actually were pretty poor growing up, so we lived off wild game quite a bit. And to the point where, like, I remember distinctly telling my mom, like, rolling my eyes, like, we're eating venison for dinner again. Like, I just was sick of deer. But we were poor. That's what we lived off. And my dad really never pressured me to hunt, but it was immediately drawn. Like, I was hooked in. I remember being 10 in a Washington hunter safety class, and got my hunter safety card when I was 10. I got a 30-30 to hunt with open sights at age 11. Age 12 for Christmas, my dad got me a little 308. Shot my first buck that year. Pretty good buck too. Whitetail in the snow by myself. My dad dropped me off and said, "Okay, there's a scrape. I want you to hunt this scrape." And so I sat in that scrape for about an hour, and I got cold. And I remember he parked the truck kind of like 100 yards away from the scrape, and I think it was 12, so I just walked over, started the truck up, and got the heat on. And I was just sitting there shivering. I got warm, turned the truck off. I got out of the truck, and here comes a buck walking to that scrape with a doe. And I believe I shot him like standing up, not on a rest, fur in the scope, boom. Put two in him, and then my dad heard the shots. He was hunting a different scrape. And about a mile away, he came over and I got my first buck, and I just remember how proud he was of me. And then, like, it was a deer camp, like a classic deer camp filled with his peers. And I was the only 12-year-old there, and all these grown men were like so impressed and like giving me attaboys. So, like, it was a tremendous experience, and I was hooked. But, like we talked about, as soon as I hit junior high, man, like, it was all about sports.
Sure.
And so I didn't hunt from the time I hit junior high till the time I graduated high school. And my dad did such a good job of like exposing me to hunting that the second I graduated high school, I was going to play baseball at a small CC on the west side of Washington. At the last second, I decided to just quit baseball and go to school locally, like we were talking about in your pre-roll. And I said, "Well, Dad, I like hunting. Let's go hunting again." And he was like, "Okay." And that's a whole nother story, but I just got right back into hunting. So he did a good job. And but yeah, sports was a big part of my life. And I've talked about this on my pod before, but like when I was 14, my parents rented out this dude's basement while we built a house in the country. And in the basement trail was like this legitimate gym that this guy had, home gym. And he caught me down there messing around. Like I didn't know what I was doing. And he was a really nice guy, but he was just like pretty stern. And he was like, "Look, man, you can hurt yourself down here, or I can show you how to do this the right way, dial in your nutrition, and we can like pack a lot of muscle on you." So like from 7th to 8th grade summer, I spent that summer training with this dude. It was mainly bodybuilding stuff, but like he had me on creatine at age
Oh, wow.
13. And this is like 90s, man. Like there wasn't a lot of research, and he had me on these weight gainer shakes, and he just made me eat a ton and lift. I put on like 20 pounds of muscle that summer, probably a combination of that and puberty. And I just remember walking into 8th grade and nobody recognized me. They're
What
like
happened
I
to
was a
you?
different person. And I loved the
Wow.
confidence that I could take to football and wrestling. And so a love of strength, conditioning, delayed gratification, results, a whole bunch of stuff happened there. And that was where that passion ignited to where fitness has been a part of my life since that point going forward, and probably always will be.
Isn't that crazy that a guy just walks into your life, a random moment at an age where it just clicked for you? And
Yeah.
I mean, do you wonder? You always wonder. I mean, you really only have hindsight, and you can't really dictate what would have happened. But I often wonder, like, what would happen if that didn't happen? You know what I mean? What would have you have found? Or would you have found it? Because it's crazy how things happen. Because now it's become such, I mean, a part of your life, both personally and professionally, I would say. So, I mean, what a cool thing that some person took the opportunity to mentor a youth, which is cool.
No, it
That's
is.
neat.
The cool thing was like I basically went down that path of like bodybuilding. That's what I'm gonna call it, but muscle hypertrophy, try to be as big as possible. And then I think it was my first elk season with a bow in 2001 that pretty much I was like, I don't need to weigh 185 pounds. And I have never weighed that much ever since.
All right.
I struggled to weigh 160. I'm not a big guy, but I used to be pretty bulky, and it just didn't work for elk hunting. And
Sure.
that elk hunting fitness requirements definitely put a fork in the road on my fitness journey, where I just started not caring about the size of muscle bellies and really started caring about muscle endurance and performance. And so it's been a journey, but all these passions kind of collide into where elk shape is literally, you can distill it down to, I love elk hunting. I love being fit for elk hunting. It's how I elk hunt. The two are like, they're not exclusive. They're together. And so fitness has kind of been the glue to a lot of my archery success.
How many days a week do you work out, and for how long?
I don't work out very long. I don't have a lot of time to work out very long. I would say I need to be in and out in an hour. I'm older now, so it takes me a lot longer to get warmed up. And my gym is kind of cold. I have an outside gym, and there's just not a great heat source in there. It doesn't get that warm. Like it's tough for me to get sweaty. That's how. So you'll see any of my fitness content, I'll be like bundled up. It's because it's freaking cold in there, man. And in and out in an hour. 4 to 5 workouts a week. That's pretty much it. Like nothing crazy like I used to, and but just enough to kind of win the day.
I think I can't remember. It might have been you that said that. Win the day. At some point, I glommed onto that, and I was like, you know, a lot of days it feels like I struggle, you know, and you make a mistake. You go, you know, maybe your diet's not that good, or you kind of miss a workout for the day, or you don't get a chance to do the things that you think you should during that day, and you kind of go to bed with that pit in your stomach, you know. You're like, man, today I just didn't get it, man. I didn't do it. But I kind of glommed onto that win the day. I even wrote it on the back of one of my bows here a few years ago. And I think I've had people that I work with, they ask me, oh, you know, win the day, that's kind of cute. Is that for like when you're hunting, you know, like help you, like motivate you when you're hunting? And I said, actually, it was mostly pertaining just to my diet. And the first thing that I did every day was I shoot my bow, right? So I'd get up and I would get my kids to school. I would go up to the upper range and I would shoot. And I would just read that little win the day so that when I got home, it was like a little reminder to like help me work on, you know, my diet. Just like win the day. Don't eat a bunch of bullshit, you know, throughout the day. And I kind of glommed onto that. And I don't know if you said that or not, but if you did, you know, I appreciate it because it's been a motivator for me.
I got that from University of Oregon. I think they have that
Okay.
up there everywhere in their strength
Gotcha.
room. But yeah, it is a decision that we all have to make, and it doesn't come without sacrifice. All my workout sessions come with some sort of sacrifice in the day. And if I'm being honest, like it's not the first thing I feel like doing. I'm going to train today and I don't really want to. I have so much going on, but I will regret it so much if I don't. And I need to stack those wins. I've said it in different ways, but it's like a making deposits into that mental toughness account that I definitely am going to tap into in September. And there's like a lot of public land hunting I do is it feels like a competition to some degree. And so I like just do little Michael Jordan things and play tricks with myself, and I tell myself things like, you know, I shot more arrows than everybody on this mountain. I broke sweat more than everybody in this mountain. I e-scouted, I did the research, I just put more work in. I have an advantage over these guys and I need to show them. And that's not necessarily what's going on there at all, but
But it motivates you.
it does. And so you got to do what you got to do.
I was going to ask you, do you ever, have you ever, I know you like to shoot your bow. Nobody that seems to shoot as much as you do doesn't genuinely enjoy it. I don't think that you purely do it just because, I think in part you probably do it because you want to be your best in September, and I think you owe it to the animal, and I think you think that too. But I think in reality, you genuinely like shooting your bow. I was curious, have you ever felt like, you know, working out or fitness or anything like that, do you think it impacts your ability to shoot your bow? You added any issues that way? Because, I mean, I know that you follow target archery. I follow target archery. And if you look down the line of, you know, Vegas that's coming up in March, most of those guys don't look like they're spending a bunch of time in the gym every day. And I was curious, have you ever felt like, because that's why I say this because I think it's one of my excuses. I'm like, I don't want to be super sore because then I can't shoot my bow. And shooting my bow is more important than working out. How do you balance that?
No, I think you're right. Like, I do shoot my bow a ton because I enjoy it, first and foremost. It's something I can never master. And I do seem to shoot better when I put consecutive days together. And sometimes when I take like a maybe a week goes by and I haven't shot my bow, I do feel a little rusty. The first couple arrows are seem to be always like, what? I'm like, oh man, see, you don't need to shoot that much. But if you like sit there and shoot longer and longer, you're like, oh, I kind of am doing something. I forgot about this or that. So I shoot to kind of keep really fresh muscle memory. But Trell, it all comes down to the shot. At this point in my life, you can put me on just about any elk hunt. Give me enough time and I'm going to earn a shot opportunity. Kind of a bold statement, but not really. I've been elk hunting long enough to, and I think you would be the same boat. Like, put me in a unit. Whether I know it or not, give me enough time, I'm gonna earn a shot opportunity eventually. What happens on that shot is everything. And so the crux of all my hunts come down to this one thing. So I'm super paranoid to make sure I do it all the time. And it's like the one area that's glaring, like it's the one area like I could show up fit enough. I could probably even show up not fit enough and still get it done. There's guys that do it year over year, but I'm here
I
for a
do it.
there's a trajectory here where I'd like to be elk hunting as long as I'm alive, regardless of age. So that's why I mainly work out, is to just have a good trajectory of health. But it all comes down to the shot, man. And so you're right, like every day I try to shoot before I even go into the gym. Rarely do I shoot after I work out. And then even if like we're making a YouTube video or something, and I go work out first, and then we got to go shoot, and these arrows are going to be on video, it is in the back of my mind, like I broke down muscle. It's not going to, because there's a lot of muscle involved in shooting a bow, but there's also a lot of broken down muscle when you're hunting and you're on your feet for 12 to 14 hours a day, day over day. Like you're not a fresh spring chicken when. So I do think it's good to shoot your bow when you're tired, when after a workout, before a workout. But I do think to summarize, is shoot your bow. And even if like we're doing the December Chub Challenge right now, and a lot of guys, they have to shoot their bow every day to qualify for these prizes. It's like, well, you get up, it's dark, and you go to work, and you get home, and it's dark. Okay, well, I guess you're blank bailing. And honestly, that's a great thing for you. Like, you're just working on your mechanics. There's no target involved. You're just hardwiring good muscle memory, stacking the odds in your favor. So I don't think fitness should ever be something you don't do because of shooting your bow. And, like Bodie Turner is a good friend of mine. I hope he wins Vegas. I hope he wins Lancaster again. Him and I have been working on his fitness for the last 2 years, and you'll see a significant difference in his body structure by just, and I think he's going to continue to be dominant in that sport, in a very competitive sport, because he's taking his nutrition ex like more serious on his nutrition than he is on his fitness, and he's being consistent, and it's on his radar, and I think that's going to, I think it's going to pay off huge for him.
Yeah, it's been fun to follow along with Bodie. He was such a phenom at such a young age, to then kind of watch him develop and grow up and mature and continue to win, and then just almost just to like see him develop as a man, which is pretty cool. Is it, and I don't know Bodie. I mean, I see Bodie comment from time to time, and I think he and I have exchanged some DMs, just like, good luck. And I was hoping to bump into him in Vegas last year, but didn't get a chance. And anytime I'm down there in Vegas, and those guys that shoot at that level, I'm like, I just want to keep away from them and let them do their thing. Like, I don't want to jinx them, you know what I mean? But he's been really fun to follow along with, and that's cool that you've been working with him. I didn't know that.
Yeah, we've been low key on it and just staying in touch. It's tough because he's still in high school, right? So like I can't, we don't live that far. We live 4 hours apart. But like he doesn't have the capacity to like actually train with me here in person. So it's a lot of like text and stuff. But he's got a lot going for him for somebody who's still in high school. And I think he's turning 18 soon. So, like, he hasn't even signed with a bow company yet because he's just not even 18. You know what I mean? Like, can you imagine getting a whatever $50,000 check at age 17 or 16 and then, like, hey, mom and dad, he's a stud, man. The guy's a stud.
Yeah, he's always been really cool to watch, and so composed and put together. And then, I mean, obviously with Joel as his dad, just the mental, the fortitude and the mental side of that game it's impressive for anybody, but it's really impressive for a kid, for a young guy anyway. But what do you have him eating every day? I was curious. That was one of the questions I was going to ask you, is like, what are you eating a day, Dan? What do you suggest for people?
Well, Bodie's doing really well with a lower carb diet. Like, so he's pretty carnivore through and through, and it's what he likes to eat. It's what makes him feel good. So he's burning fat for energy. He's not burning carbs. I'm probably more, I'll do more carbs pre-workout, post-workout. I try to center my carb, take in carbs based on the days that I'm training and pre and post. And I love carbohydrates. They're like the best. So I have to be careful there. But no, everything is like protein centered. Mornings, I don't like, I haven't had breakfast yet, and it's 9:34 a.m. PST. I will probably have my first food encounter in about an hour or so, and it'll just be like today, it's elk backstrap and rice. I'll probably have 6, 7 ounces of elk meat, a cup of rice, let that digest, work out. Post-workout will probably be some fruit and a protein. And then I potentially will have one more like elk steak rice combo. I try to eat that twice a day. And then dinner will be whatever my lovely wife makes. And it's usually centered around chicken or elk. I don't love fish. Not a huge like pork chop guy or like not really into that. It's usually wild game, believe it or not, and it's usually elk, some sort of veggies, and for carbs in the evening, it's usually like yams or squash, something like. It's not pasta. It's not, you know. I'd love it to be. I just don't feel good on that, so I really watch that. We always eat a really big salad with dinner because I want to be full. Like I like being full, and my appetite kind of like picks up as the day goes on. I don't wake up hungry, probably because I drink coffee and things like that. But yeah, I would say like on a good day, I'm having 3 to 4 real good food encounters with real food, like, and it's just mainly elk steak and rice or ground elk and rice. And then dinner can be whatever my wife makes. Like tonight we're having elk meatloaf, which I absolutely love. There will be some sort of yam and then a giant salad. And I mean, I eat a lot when I eat. Like I don't weigh and measure food per se, but like I'm probably at 2,200 calories a day, somewhere in there. And I always just try to make sure that I'm getting enough protein to kind of match how much lean body mass I have. So it's chop like 140 grams of protein a day, something like that. And I don't weigh and measure. And I don't like get my body fat measured very often. I kind of gauge everything on performance. I kind of pursue performance, not aesthetics, if that makes sense. So.
Yeah, the way you feel, right? You process the way you're feeling and you adjust.
Yep.
What do you, I mean, do you, you're not like, I mean, pardon me saying this, but I don't think you're like superhuman by any means. I think you must struggle, right? With cravings. There's, sugar, salt, sweet, whatever it might be. What kind of advice do you give to people, either clients or, somebody like myself that like struggles with that kind of thing, like temptation of food? It's funny to me, and like I've told people this before, but like I would rather run, 5 to 10 miles a day, twice a day, than like, well, it's easier to do that than watch what I eat, which is so bizarre to me because it's literally just putting food in your mouth, right? So like what advice, how long did it take you, or what mindset, what tips do you have for people that might struggle with diet specifically?
Well, this is a whole podcast in itself, bro, but we'll stick to the like, so who does the grocery shopping in
I
your
do.
house? I don't. You do?
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool. I don't. So like when, and so I'm gonna err on the side of trying to be extremely relatable for people that think I'm a robot. I am not a robot. I'm definitely human as they come, to my own detriment. And having an 8 and 10 year old, my wife will put things in our cabinets that are seductive to me. There are just some bullshit food in our cabinets right now. If we went to my house and did an audit, I bet there's like Pop Tarts. Like our kids should not be having Pop Tarts. Like that's cocaine. There's probably some sort of crackers and stuff like for their lunches and stuff that like I would love to snack on, but it all starts with like who does the grocery shopping and are you on the same page with your spouse or significant other? Or if you're living solo, there's really no excuse. But like what you buy is what's in your cabinets, is what is readily available. So, that's the biggest thing for me is like doing meal prep weekly, getting the Traeger, getting all the protein made because protein takes the longest to make. Cooking, like I bring my lunch to work every day, it's in the fridge. So I don't go out to lunch. I don't ever shop out of convenience, which is where poor decisions are made. So a little plan and preparing on what you bring home from the grocery store and when you cook your food for the week, that will help alleviate. And I'm not saying you need to be 100% perfect. I think 80-20 in life is awesome. If you could be successful 80% of the time and accept 20% poor decision making, being human, things like that. But like for me, I can't even remember last time I had a drop of alcohol. And you're talking to a guy who it's not a religious decision, it's not an alcoholic type decision. It's just like it doesn't sound appealing when I know I'm gonna train the next day. I love having a nice cold IPA at Elk Camp when I get back. And I haven't even done that 2 years in a row. I have not bought beer.
Gotcha.
It's just not, I don't know. And to the point where my wife makes fun of me, like I don't even socially drink or whatever, because it just doesn't align with what I'm trying to do. And so maybe evaluate what it is you're trying to accomplish. Yeah, the last thing I was going to tell you was like the overindulgence of carbohydrates and sugars can make things seem like, I don't know, it kind of almost like dulls your senses to where, like, I think, Trail, if you're eating pretty clean and you get a craving, a sweet tooth in the evening, one or a half a cup of Greek yogurt and a cup of blueberries could and should be a dessert. But if you're eating sugar all day, that's not a dessert, man. Ice cream's a dessert or a piece of cake is a dessert. So like I think you almost have to desensitize your taste buds back to like what clean eating looks like. And then over time you like to me like a that yogurt blueberry combo is a great sweet tooth. That'll definitely scratch the itch and it will taste really sweet to me because I haven't had an overabundance of sugar throughout the day to almost like downgrade that experience, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, makes total sense. What I'm hearing, I think more than anything, kind of what I'm hearing is that I think willpower and your ability to monitor that, it's a muscle, I think, right? Just in itself, it grows over time. Your ability to say no, your ability to make the right choice when it presents itself, like you stop at a gas station and you're starving. That ability to exercise your willpower must grow in time, right? It must take time and effort, which I mean, I know that for a fact. I've done it. It's hard to get started sometimes. It's if you ever had like those moments in your life that are like mental switches where they're like a hard switch. You're like, okay, I'm all in on something and it happens. I wish I could pinpoint that. Like what it is that when that happens, and then I wish I could replicate it. That much more often, but it's definitely something that I think you have to grow. And listening to you talk, I mean, it sounds like you, I know that you must struggle with those things, but you probably much less so than you did at some point in your life.
I like what you said. Like everything's a muscle, like your gratitude. Every day you wake up, it's a muscle if you flex it or not. Like we all should wake up every day being like, dude, I live in America. Holy crap. This is amazing. I have oxygen in my lungs. Oh my gosh. I just saw a sunrise. That was beautiful. My children are healthy. You know, if you don't flex those gratitude muscles, you might, especially with social media, just go down that hole of being negative and it can consume you. And I think the same thing for mental toughness, man. Like there are a lot of people who think they're mentally tough and are going to be fine in the mountains, but I'm telling you, day eight of a 5 day hunt, yeah, and you're out of food. If you haven't been working that mental toughness muscle all year long, it's going to be tough to dig deep. So, yeah, everything's a muscle. Discipline is a muscle. You just got to, like, no atrophy, continue to work it and know that this time of year, especially, it's the easiest to succumb to these low-hanging poor decisions, or you can work those muscles.
I like that. You can choose to work that muscle. I wanted to ask you, I wanted to get into some more, and I don't want to keep you all day, but I wanted to get into some more like archery related stuff, some gear stuff, and some tinkering. But before I did, kind of before I leave this subject, I was curious. This is like a personal question I wanted to ask you. Do you have, I mean, you run a website, you have your content channels. I think it's growing a lot, right? I've watched it and I consume your content and followed along with like your whole journey. Do you, I mean, you have people that look up to you. You have people that kind of are aspiring to kind of do what you do, but do you have people that you look up to? Are there people that you follow in the industry? Are there people that came before us that you look at and you're like, man, that person really inspires me? Like, who do you follow?
Oh yeah. Well, that's a tough question. So, and the reason why it's tough is because I've had so much good influence throughout the years. I got into hunting, obviously we talked about that, but like I got into hunting when I got a bow. Like that was a like you literally just talked about moments where you went all in, and that was when I shot a bull elk with a rifle at 20 yards on public land in Washington State. And I walked up to it and it was so big. And the second I did some research via DVD and VHS and magazines that these things bugle in September and you can only really hunt them with a bow, that was a decision for me to go get a bow. And that decision was all in, like that was it. And that proceeded to follow countless books, magazines. That's the media that I could consume. That's the information that I had at my fingertips. So I didn't have a podcast or I didn't have a 2.0 filtering from Go Hunt at my fingertips. I had to read every state's proclamation and all these things, like send in applications with a pen and paper and a check and a different envelope for each species. Like I'm dating myself, but like I was all in back in the day. And so anyone writing books, I would read. I read a Chuck Adams book, Life at Full Draw. I still have that book somewhere, but like to me, that book spoke to me. So Chuck Adams had a huge like influence on me through his writings. I was able to connect with Dwight Schrute when he was alive. He's actually the guy who gave me a column in Bowhunter magazine writing about fitness that probably nobody read for several years. And so I really look up to Dwight Schrute. I got to hunt with Larry D. Jones twice, and once in Idaho and once in Montana, and just learn his style, his way, and watch. See, at the time trail, I think Larry was in his early 70s, and he walked like a 70-year-old until a bull bugled. And then it was like I couldn't even keep up with this dude. Like he turned into a young man because of the bugle juice. So I really looked up to Larry. I thought Dwight and Larry were pioneers as far as making tapes and VHS. And literally in one of their Elk Fever videos, they like had a segment about preparing fitness wise and putting backpacks on. And Dwight was doing his little triathlons. And I was like, so these guys kind of paved the way for like elk hunting fitness type thing that really spoke to me. And so Dwight, rest in peace, love that guy, one of the best writers ever. Larry's still alive, God bless him. I actually don't know Chuck Adams at all, but I read his books. I thought he was great. And so yeah, those were some of the early guys to inspire me.
I think it's incredible that you still see Chuck's still killing animals every single year, which is to me is incredible. I mean, he's still going to Kodiak Island and he's still hunting, Sitka blacktail deer on Kodiak. I mean, anybody that's been to Kodiak isn't a, it's not a breeze, like there's some steep country on Kodiak. Like he's still killing elk. I think he killed a bison. It's just, that guy is truly amazing to me. And I don't know how old he even is. He's got to be in his 70s, I would bet. Maybe older.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is so gnarly. But yeah, that's super cool. I was curious though, because I know you're probably about, how old are you? Do you care if I ask?
No, I don't care. I'm 43.
Okay, gotcha. So I just turned 45, so you and I are pretty similar in age. It's funny, it's interesting, like in talking to you, and we've met before, it's like you kind of get, you get a sense of somebody like their generation. And I've felt like generationally you and I are kind of the same. Like I get the same feeling. I did the same things. I mean, very, very similar upbringings. And so I think, yeah, it was interesting. I just was curious as to like who you follow and who you look up to. I want to dive into some like archery related stuff. I wanted to know, I've been asking people, I had Henry Ferguson on last week. Henry's from Colorado. You know, he's killed a bunch of giant mule deer and he's been a, you know, diehard bow hunter. But I was, one of the things I asked him, and I've been trying to ask people that are primarily bow hunters, is factors that make you more accurate, things that make you more deadly. So one of the things I wanted to ask you was, do you feel like there are factors, whether it's a piece of equipment, whether you feel like it's coaching, whether you feel like it's mental perspective, what is it that has helped you most? Would you say maybe a couple of tips that has helped you most be more accurate in the field on elk?
Oh, okay. That's a tough question, Trill.
I'm like Oprah up here with the tough questions.
I don't know what you did, but like when I, in 2001, when I went to a bow shop and picked out a bow, I don't remember those guys like taking measurements too much. And I don't even remember setting up the bow. I just remember like coming home and started shooting.
Yep.
And I missed a lot of elk early on and deer. And so I really struggled with managing excitement, quite honestly, mental management of archery. And that, looking back, like I've still missed a lot of animals to this day. Like, imagine if I'd never missed. Oh my gosh, for like quite the resume. So like, don't think we don't all miss. That still happens. But if you're new, I would love to see people get like, just like working out, like get a coach and get somebody to teach you the fundamentals in the beginning. Like, I didn't get that. And so it was kind of like a long, slow, painful rerouting muscle memory from incorrect to correct. So just establishing some fundamentals will help you in the long run. And I think it'd be so worth it to find a coach, pay them good money, get a couple sessions with everyone having a video camera and their phone, like film the session, review the session, practice the principles. Those will go a long ways. That would be great. Like I was fortunate enough to like my neighbor's Josh Jones. I've known him for 20 years. He's always worked on my bows. I think there was a significant, and I think you've been working on bows longer than me, man. But like in 2019, I don't know why, but I drew a line in the sand and I said, I am no longer taking my bow to Josh and having him do everything. And then I don't even question how anything works. Like I just decided to get my checkbook out. I bought a bow press, a draw board. I was already making my own arrows, but I didn't know anything about tuning bows. So I really dove deep and I'm still learning, but man, I know so much now compared to what I just a few years ago, like 5 years ago, I didn't know how to even set up a bow. Now I feel like I could really identify what's wrong, how to make it tune. And that has given me so much more confidence. So like, I think there's something to be said about investing in yourself and your education. And there was like this thing, Trail, where like almost a lot of pro shops didn't want you working on your own equipment.
Yeah.
You know, they were fearful that you'd be taking away labor that they could be charging you. But I think, and I think it's a fact that if you need something from a pro shop, you'll still go down there. I was literally at the pro shop last week buying things that I needed. But learning the ins and out of working on a bow has really changed my confidence in how it works. The last thing is I've also had private coaching with Joel Turner multiple times to help my mental management. And I still get refresher courses from time to time. So I've just had some great allies that have helped me, that have sped up that learning curve quite a bit. And then the last thing I'll say is like, I don't know it all. I'm a student for life. And I hope that comes through on my content. Like, I don't try to have a real strong opinion. I have to try to have an open mind and hear everyone's narrative and try to find my own truths.
Yeah. That's all good advice. It, as you were talking, it's interesting what people spend their money on, myself included, because, you know, I can justify spending money on, you know, a $300 release, right? Which in reality is probably not going to majorly impact my accuracy or consistency unless I learn how to shoot that release properly. But I could spend that same money, you know, given the day and age, to hire, you know, somebody like George Riles, who does online coaching. I mean, the guy's a phenomenal coach. He's done amazing. And he's just one. I'm sure there are many others, but it is interesting to me where you prioritize your money. And I agree. That's a great tip. Hire a coach. Spend the money where it matters the most. And until you learn to shoot the equipment that you've got, it's really not going to give you the benefit that you could possibly gain from it by just having some coaching, whether it's mental or, you know, even physical, draw length, whatever it might be. So that's good advice. I like that one. I wanted to ask you, like, what goes through your mind the second before you release an arrow, whether it's at a target or an animal? What are you thinking?
Well, hopefully I'm thinking and not blacking out. You know what I mean? Hopefully I'm talking to myself, having like some dialogue. Mm-hmm. And it's that darn emotion of, oh my gosh, this is happening, which is funny because it's like, how many times have I been down that road? And yet it's still like, oh my gosh, this is happening. So that is like very dangerous self-talk right there. Like to be like, you like perceive urgency. And so I try to mitigate that to where, man, I've been here before. It's not urgent. They don't know I'm there, that kind of thing. So like the last animal I killed this year was actually a while ago. It was in October, early October, is a Montana bull. And it was one of those days where we had 70 mile an hour gusts the night before. I couldn't even have my rooftop tent up because I checked the weather and I was like, oh, that thing will blow over. So yeah. Sleeping in the bed of my truck, and my whole truck was moving all night long. And when I got up, it was still pretty dang windy. And I was in Montana and in public land. I hiked up to the top of this BLM chunk, and in the skyline, I see the elk coming over onto public. And this particular area was, we'll call it a little bit more eastern Montana. And it was just like, these buggers don't like to spend much time on public. So you got a finite window to get them in transition. You're not hunting them in their bedroom. Their bedroom is private. Mm-hmm. So I kind of was hustling, and the herd bull had one hot cow kind of sequestered. All the satellites were together, kind of like bugling and sparring. And the majority of the herd was in the trees. And then this bull had one cow kind of hooked. The rest of his ladies were in the background, and the wind was just howling, man. And so I dipped into the coulee, cut the distance, got him at 54 ranged, feeding, not knowing I was there. And looking back, I just was pretty calm, pretty excited that the bull didn't know I was there and that he was feeding. And people talk about, taking that shot selection, which is very important, right? But I do think before you like go like shot placement, it does come down to shot selection. And the shot that I had selected was a slightly quartering away animal feeding, not knowing that I was there. It doesn't sound much better than that, right? Like honestly, like he doesn't know I'm there. That's perfect. So I got to click. I got to dial to the exact yardage, pull back, pick out a spot. And so I used to stare at a pin when I was shooting my bow in the early days. And somewhere along my journey, I figured out for me, I'm way more accurate if I look at what I'm trying to hit, and yep, the pin kind of blurs out, is blurry, but I'm definitely, and so I'm picking out this spot and the shot breaks and I didn't, you know, I was like, oh, you know, that is like, to me, that doesn't happen every time, being honest.
Yeah.
And to me, like, that is the absolute most perfect way to shoot an elk, is to have a complete surprise release and a complete break and watch that arrow go. The other elk I killed that year, like, not all those went that way. Like, they, one bull I killed in Utah was full alert. And I don't love shooting at full alert elk. You know what I mean? Especially that shot was 55. That's not my favorite. And I felt way more urgency because he was staring holes through me. And I can go through, you know, several different instances where, you know, the elk's behavior adds this additional sense of urgency.
Yep.
That I've just learned over time. Like, that's what you're dealing with. That's, as an archer, you're like literally battling yourself and the self-talk that you have more time than you think.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'll end it with, like, many years ago, there was a time and a place in Idaho where this non-resident at the time could drive to elk camp, stop at a vendor gas station and buy himself an elk tag and go out there and hunt his ass off, kill an elk, and look at his calendar and say, I got 10 more days until I have to be back at work. I'll drive back to that gas station and buy me a second elk tag. Yes, folks, that used to be the way. And God bless those days, Trell, because then Dan would be a little bit more picky. And so I would have more elk encounters, and that voice of urgency was really muted because I called an elk in and I was like, I want to give this bull a better look to see what he really is versus just, I got to shoot as soon as I see it. And so I really started to learn that, like, call-ins, sneaking in, patience, that, oh my gosh, I would have shot that bull, Trail, right then and there. And that would have been a 33-yard, quartering 2-yard shot. But because I didn't shoot, holy crap, this bull now came and swung around and he's sitting there 14 yards looking the other way, bugling. You know what I mean? So I learned through that second tag, which you can't do anymore. I learned a lot of elk encounters of like waiting and being patient for a better shot selection. And I think that's the best thing that could ever happen to me was getting all those elk encounters under my belt to where it's not that first second that you have to shoot. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's awesome advice. Yeah, it's yeah, and I mean, I'm a classic example. I screwed up this year on a bull, the same reason, just everything that even after all these years that I've been hunting, I can still screw up by pushing my own limits, you know, pushing the you know, the time that I think that I've got, you know, getting in my own head. You said something I actually thought was really interesting, as you said, and when I asked you what's going through your head, you said, hopefully something. You're like, hopefully it's not just blackout, you know, like that I'm really doing it, which reminded me, we had a guy that was a bronc rider. He was there at the NFR. We had him on the podcast last week there in Vegas. And I asked him, you know, what is it like when you jump on the back of a, you know, a bronc and, you know, they turn you out of the chute, like what's going through your head? And he was like, for the first few, you know, several times, he was basically like, I kept having this thought, like, oh, I'm really doing it. I'm doing it. Holy shit, I'm really doing it, you know? And I think I've had that thought on elk. Like I've gone to full draw on elk and I'm like, holy shit, this is really happening. Like I'm really
Yeah.
doing it, you know, which I don't think is the frame of mind that I should be in. You know, you have to pick something. You know, I was talking to Henry last week and Henry was saying basically he focuses on reach your anchor point, you know, find your anchor point. That's kind of like his holding statement. I think Joel teaches, you know, the same kind of thing of like having purpose and intent. And I think that was a good point that you made is like, if you don't have anything going through your mind, find something to focus on, find something to sit to kind of occupy your mind to keep you intentional in the shot. So that was good, man. You said a lot of really good stuff there. This is like one of those episodes I'll probably have to go back and listen to myself just to like hear what you said because I think there's a lot of real good tips in it. I wanted to ask you some gear questions, and I don't want to keep you forever. You can cut loose, and every time you need to go, I said an hour, but maybe I'll get you for an hour and 20 if you got a minute. You got a minute? Okay.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about arrows specifically. So this year, I know that you got, and I know you're a gear guy. You've got a gear page now, right? Separate page, elk shaped gear. I know that you into the gear, but I wanted to ask you about the arrows. So Easton 5.0s versus like the Parallel Pros from last year. I wanted to ask you like your opinion on the Parallel Pros, what you thought of them after using them for a season. I bought a dozen. I've said pretty publicly that they were not my favorite arrow. I just didn't have a good durability out of them, I didn't think. So I wanted to ask you like going forward, what you think you'll end up using and why.
Well, I'm wondering what you put on your components for your Parallel Pros.
Yeah, I didn't. I put the titanium half outs, which was not a great choice.
So I took those Parallel Pros to TAC, and I had a bad day at TAC, man. Like, I don't know. It's a long story, but I had shortened my draw length to 26 and a half. And dude, that was not good because it was too much compression. And it really, if your draw length's too short and you're shooting steep angles, good luck being consistent with your anchor. And actually, Joel and Bodie pointed that out to me this summer, and I went back to 27, and my God, what a game changer. But my point of that is I was just shooting parallel pros, and man, I hit a lot of hard stuff that day on the mountain. And we had an arrow spinner back at the Airbnb, and I only brought like a dozen, and I had like half of them just wobbling and bad, bent. And I know had it been any other arrow, it was like, damn, these are really perfect straight, best tolerance arrows, but they're not durable. Then neighbor Josh Jones comes out with this two-piece titanium half out for 4 mil, and he's wanting to sell them. And so he's like, hey, I'll give you some if you make a video on it. And I'm like, well, I'll make a video on it regardless. Give me those, give me those.
Sure.
And I have literally trail shot, not on purpose, some steel targets. And hit the steel target, and the parallel pro goes boom and bounces back. I hot melted them, looked at it, hot heated it up, pulled the component off because it's bent, spin it, good to go. It's like, holy shit. So then I have put those back on. And so I will say, if you're running anything other than that two-piece titanium, in my experience, you hit rebar or anything, you're gonna bend that arrow, you're gonna be like, you're out an arrow. It's just pretty much not an arrow you'd put a broadhead on. So that's really changed the game for me. And I even talked to Easton. I was like, guys, like your half outs are awesome. I love the O-ring, the little orange O-ring. It's great. You have all these steel, titanium, and aluminum options are great. But like, you need to do a titanium one like Josh's, a two piece that's got a collar and a half out that marry. It is literally making your arrow, your be the best arrow, the arrow that has won the most tournaments ever, durable, which without that, I think it is. So to answer your tinkering question, I'm loving the Parallel Pros. I'm going to Texas with the Parallel Pros. I'm running that two piece. It's $10 a component. It's not cheap. And I do know that. But I'd say, like, for those that want the absolute best arrow, and if you're gonna like freak out like I am and geek out on every arrow and whittle them down to your best. I have 3 dozen over here, uncut shafts ready to go. Like they all will be winners when I'm done with them. I won't have to batch through and like, you know what I mean? I don't have to knock tune. These are dialed. The 5.0s are great. I think they're it's like nice to see Easton finally come to market with these. And I kind of had a bad attitude towards Easton. I was like, because I was running RIP TKOs for a long time because I'm just tired of the weight of the Axis. The Easton Axis is one of my favorite arrows, which is too heavy GPI. So, like, I went to TKOs, and then now Easton's got something that's even lighter GPI than the TKO, and I think a little bit more durable. And I like their half out collar system that comes with the match grade now, to where I'm thinking, the 5 mil is just going to give you so many more opportunities with different broadheads and configurations that I think a lot of guys should probably go with the Easton 5.0 over the Parallel Pro. The last thing I'll say about going 4 mil for me is like, I definitely run a pretty tall vane. It's an AE Hybrid HP, and I'm still fighting wind drift like a champ with those Parallel Pros. I don't have to aim off very much in high winds versus a 5 mil arrow. So I still think the 4 mil penetrates a little bit better, is a the straightest, most best tolerances, and fights off wind drift big time. And with that titanium two piece, I've got the durability to where I like it, to where I still think that's going to be the arrow for me.
What veins are you using? You just mentioned it, but say it again.
So AE hybrid material, high profile, HP. It essentially looks like a blazer.
Are you shooting them in a four fletch or a three fletch?
Three with about a 5 degree offset.
Your arrows look unique, and I know that you know that, right? As far as your vane configuration, I mean, a lot of people have kind of abandoned the blazer profile of vanes. A lot of guys have gone to four fletch, lower profile, stiffer vanes. You typically don't see as much helical on vanes that I see on your arrows. So I was curious, why are you sticking with it? Is it just what works best for you? I would assume, knowing that you like to tinker as much as you do, that you've probably tried some other things, but why stick with it?
Yeah. So like I was getting, I love a lot of spin on my arrow, always have. Mm-hmm. I felt like it always showed up 50 yards and beyond for arrow recovery. And I didn't think there was too much drag involved. And there was a stint when I was running max stealths with that big of an offset where I would see some parachuting, you know. And with the HPs, it's a high enough profile to where I can steer a significant chunk of metal in the front. I'm not getting parachute. And honestly, I don't see it in my long range shots, too much drag, where I see my arrows competing with tack vanes and all sorts of stuff. And I have all those. I try everything.
Yeah.
So I think for me, it always comes down to what's going to steer a broadhead the best. And at the end of the day, a lot of spin without parachute has shown up for me. And that's why I kind of typically have an FOC front of center of around 15%. Not for anything else, but shots past 50 in the wind, like fighting off, because it's windy in the mountains. Like it's always windy in the mountains, you know, it's never just calm. So to me, that's what's shown up on what matters, which is broadheads. And I think people know I prefer a fixed broadhead on elk. And so when you're steering a big chunk of metal, that's kind of what I've figured out currently what works the best for me. So that's why I run those, and that's why I put a pretty significant offset on them.
Yeah. Did you you brought up broadheads. I know that you like a fixed blade head for elk, and you guys put out a video. Did you get a lot of comments back about about mechanicals and fixed blades?
Oh, man. That video, god dang it. So it was at our elk immersion experience, and one of our dudes was filming on his cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not know that. So I was like pretty unfiltered. I would have filtered it way more for YouTube audience. He sends it to me about a month after the camp, and I'm looking at it, and I literally almost didn't publish it three different times. I'm like, I don't feel like controversy, but it is the way I truly feel about fixed versus mechanical. And, you know, it's like talking about heavy versus light. I mean, everyone's got an opinion. And so I published it. I did. Yeah. I published it knowing that it was going to make some people mad. But I do go back to, I got to say this so carefully. I'm 43. I'm not going to say how many elk I've killed, but it's with a bow. But I would say it's quite a significant amount compared to most people. And that's not to impress anyone. I've said that before. It's to impress upon you. I have effed up on a lot of elk. I have had a lot of success, but more importantly, I've been blessed to have a ton of time logged elk hunting, helping other people recover their elk, shooting elk, cutting up elk. I mean, a significant amount. So like my opinion does have more weight to it, if we're being honest, just due to the fact that I've had more time than a lot of people cutting up elk, killing elk, recovering elk, screwing up elk. I do want to emphasize screwing up elk. And to me, the biggest thing about screwing up elk encounters is rushing the shot, showing up in the mountains where you think you're going to know the exact yardage. And I'm here to tell you, 9 times out of 10, it's always going to be an ish. Elk move. You don't have time to range them when they're standing. You pre-range, whether it's a call in or sneak in. And so I've found that flat trajectory will help for short draw length guys like me, a lot of energy. A really tuned arrow where it's leaking zero energy on its way to the animal. A very sharp broadhead, 2 or 3 blade fix seems to be good. But more importantly, people will say shot placement. And I always say no, shot selection first. Mm-hmm. An alert elk quartering to you could be a nightmare. You know what I mean? A severe quartering away with a mechanical in the morning, shooting through an elk with a stomach full of hay, could be a bad deal for everybody involved. Things like that, you know, I don't tell people how much their arrows should weigh and stuff like that. I think they should really test and vet and figure out what gives them the most confidence. But, you know, shot shot placement is important, but before that, it's shot selection. And I will never clown on anyone for what bow they use. I seriously don't. Yes, I shoot for Matthews, but I don't care what you shoot. I don't care what arrow you use or what broadhead. I just want you to put the work in and to do whatever it takes to show up with the most confidence in your own ability to know what you are capable of, and most importantly, know what you're not capable of and have a line in the sand.
Yeah. Yeah, that's well said. I think everything, I mean, it's like anything that you say, whether if you're in your business or kind of my business, the way that we make a living and pay the mortgage, has the ability to just, you know, go out online and then people can take it for whatever context that it is, you know, whatever they want to create in their head, right? So I think it's always good to explore it and add context to it. And I agree with you. I mean, shoot what your experience tells you to shoot, shoot what you're confident in. But then ultimately, I agree with you, you know, make sure that you're testing it and trying it. And yeah, I mean, people, I shot fixed blades forever. I shot a mechanical, I shot a spike and lost it in 01, 02, maybe something like that. And then switched over to fixed blades and I shot fixed blades forever and ever and ever. And then I tried a mechanical probably 3 or 4 years ago and it worked great. And I've had some good results. I've had some bad results. I think a lot of the bad results have gone back to that discussion that you just said, shot selection and shot placement. I think those go hand in hand. I like what you said there, not necessarily shot placement, but shot selection, because those are, if you don't choose the right, shot, placement isn't going to matter. You have to choose the right selection. Yeah. That animal has to be in a location that you can actually make a fatal, lethal quick kill. So I like what you said there. That was good.
How many elk have you shot that you've, and you gotta be honest. I know you will. Yeah. How many elk have you shot that you thought were absolutely broadside? You thought. Mm-hmm. And then come to find out, no, it was actually quartering to you slightly. You missed one of the lungs. You got lung lever.
Yeah. Yeah. Not uncommon.
So common.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it happens so fast.
It happens quick. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like when they ask an eyewitness that observes a, you know, a crime or a car accident, right? We've seen how accurate those recollections are, and it's pretty rare. I mean, people see things so differently, especially when you have heightened senses. And I would put hunting situations right up there. My senses, my adrenaline is pumping so hard. In a lot of cases, I don't think people are seeing exactly for what it is, myself included. Like, I can speak to that with experience for sure. So,
do you think so like for mechanicals, like I'm going down to Texas with just mechanicals for deer, like no question. And I'm taking with me the Evolution Hide and Whitetail Fury and the Jekyll. I'm just kind of, and I think I even brought some Schwackers, which I've used once before. I had good results with them. Mm-hmm. And then I'm bringing Cayugas. Like when I go to Texas, that is my lab. Like I'm going, I'm at an MLD property. I can shoot as many does as possible, which I will. And I'm loading up on deer meat. So I wanted to ask you, like, I did shoot a Montana bull with a hybrid of Sever. Mm-hmm. Thinking it would be amazing. And I just didn't get the penetration I was looking for. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had to pin cushion that elk. And I made some pretty, like I think I shot that elk a total of 3 times. And every shot was absolutely perfect, like where I was aiming. You know what I mean? Like that doesn't happen very often. So that's a rear deploying pivoting system, which I really liked. And I've seen my buddy Evan Hafer of Black Rifle show me videos of some of the elk he's killed. And they're dying in seconds. And I was like, that's what prompted me to try those. Now I like them, but I'm just not convinced. So now I'm going to try these Evolutions on deer for their front deploying. I have seen like Dan Picard put down some elk. What mechanical, if you had to pick one for elk, would you go more front deploying, rear deploying? Like, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I've used Severs. That's what I've been using the last few years. And I've had relatively good luck. It's interesting with mechanicals because sometimes you'll shoot a bull and it'll absolutely just blow right through it. Like it was standing still. It was like, you know, just perfect. And it just aced it. I mean, the first bull I ever shot, I shot with a Matthews Q2, which was probably pulling 70 pounds, but I don't think that arrow could have been going 260 feet per second with an arrow that was probably 390 grains total, right? And I shot that with a rear deploying Grim Reaper 3-blade at 49 yards, and it absolutely blew through it like hot butter. I mean, it just went right through, right? So you've got something like that happens, and then sometimes you'll shoot an animal and you'll get absolutely no penetration on a mechanical. And it's hard to kind of compare the two, right, to understand exactly what happened. And, you know, I've seen fixed blades as well that just didn't seem to penetrate. I think there are some trade-offs with fixed blades. One for me is I just have never had great blood trails from a fixed blade head. It feels like all those years that I shot fixed blades, I didn't lose animals, but I also didn't have blood trails that I could follow. A lot of time it was just like pin drops, you know what I mean? And it took some real time and effort. I remember shooting a bull out of a wallow. I probably wouldn't have found that bull if he hadn't been in a wallow, but I was basically just following like drops of mud and water from the wallow, right? Because he just didn't bleed hardly at all. So it's like this constant, like, you know, pros and cons and kind of weighing it out of like what works for you, right? So for me, I feel like I don't shoot an 80 pound bow. I shoot a 70 pound bow, but I've got a 30 and a half inch draw, you know, so I've got plenty of power. I've got good power strokes. So I feel like I can shoot a mechanical. You know, I shoot about a 490, 500 grain arrow. I do like the fact that I get better blood trails, in my opinion, than a fixed blade. I feel like it's probably a little bit more forgiving at longer yardages. So it's just like it's a trade-off that you make, right? I think everybody has to go through that exercise of like, what is your personal setup? You know, what are the things that you value? What are the things that you're trying to do that are more important to you? And then try to pick a broadhead. But I mean, that's a long answer to a simple question that you ask, but I like rear deploying broadheads. I like the Severs. I like the idea of the hide, you know? But yeah, there's not many mechanicals out there. Like I probably wouldn't use a big rear deploying, you know, fold back broadhead. It's just to me that, and it's probably just doesn't make sense. Even though, like I said, I gave you a classic example of shooting one with a Grim Reaper that worked great.
those Severs are insanely accurate. Like,
yeah,
my first, like, I love that you can screw in and practice with that. And so, man, before I went to Montana, I shot like 8 or 9 shots and I just kept backing up and I was almost ruining arrows. I should have taken a picture of that group. I was like, this might be the most accurate mechanical I've ever shot. And then people were commenting like, well, you probably shot that elk with one practice one that you had screwed in. And I was like, no. I put all virgin brand new. I mean, Sever sent me a pile. So I put all brand new ones on, and I do think that is one of the most accurate mechanicals I've ever got for my setup, like ever, which is cool. Do you have reps with, I'm just thinking of all the ones people recommend all the time. They're always talking about G5s, the dead meats and the Dudley's T2 and like, there's all these ones and I just don't have reps with any of them, to be honest with you.
No, nor do I. And, I guess to be honest, like I really don't have any intent to. I mean, to me, it makes sense. The Sever makes sense, right? Like I can see the logic in it. Rear deploying, I think it flies really well, just like you're saying. And then I've had good results from it, right? So I've killed elk. I've shot elk frontal with them that have died in seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, I shot an antelope here 3 years ago, absolutely end to end. So like 30 yards. Right through the chest and came out its rear end, you know, just absolutely 12'd him. But I've just had really good results with them. And so to me, it's like, logically, it makes sense. They're sharp, they fly good. So I just keep shooting them. But I do have one of these. I don't know if you tried one of these little beast broadheads.
Yeah, I got to shoot a couple bucks with those last year in Texas. Gotcha. And I was really, really impressed. They're sharp.
Yeah. They are sharp. I haven't shot anything with them. Mostly it just sits here on my desk and I play with it. I've cut my finger a few times screwing around with it, but that is one that does intrigue me. So I might get a chance to use it maybe this fall.
Yeah, no, Bodie uses those, and I've got a lot of texts from him. He's had some great results. The other broadhead that I've used a lot, that to your point, no blood, is and I love Bill Vanderhayden, but I've
Yeah.
shot several elk with iron will standards and wides, and I will say, like, almost all of them, very little blood, but all of them have died in my sight.
Yeah.
And almost all of them don't know they were shot. And so they're not like going on a death run. They're like, shoot through double lung, and they're like looking around, and then they're walking and they get stumbling and they fall over. I think that's literally what's happened every time. So that's why I kind of always kind of gravitate towards stuff like that. But to your
Yeah.
point, I think we said it best when we said we may differ in what we use, but we're testing and vetting and showing up only what gives us confidence. And as a bow hunter, that's really, you owe it to the animal to just show up confident in yourself and in your equipment selection.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of it just bow hunting or whatever it might be. I think a lot of it just goes back to confidence, and I think you really only get confidence by reps, right? By tinkering and trying it and proofing yourself, and then going out into the field and seeing good results from your work, and that builds upon itself. And the more confident it was something. You said something interesting, I thought, on the first part of the podcast. You said, basically, if you're given enough time when you go out to any area, any unit, you're going to get an opportunity. I don't know how many people I talk to, and I bet you do too, that they continue to hunt elk year in, year out, and they're like, man, I just can't figure elk out. I can't figure elk out. And I remember being that way, but I'm like you at this point. Like, I feel like if I've got 10 days, like, I'm probably going to get an opportunity and probably multiple opportunities. And I think you really only get that by just doing the work, just year in, year out, tinkering, playing, shooting, hunting elk, buying licenses, going out, getting used to it, and hunting elk, and just and staying after it. And it is funny how it like breeds upon itself. Like, you just get more confident in it. You're like, man, I'm gonna do it. It's gonna happen.
I think it's definitely the only reason I would say such a bold statement is because I'm missing teeth. Like, I've literally had my teeth kicked in
Sure.
with the steepest learning curve. And it wasn't like one season, two season. I remember, like, Idaho especially, it took like 7 seasons of tag suit before I ever even killed an Idaho elk. All my teeth were kicked out. Like, it was, I made every mistake possible. And so if you're on that journey, you may get lucky and have a success on your first year. And I'm like, more power to you. My challenge to you is, can you duplicate consistent success? And, I think there's a level to all elk hunts where there's some luck involved, man. Like, there's
For
no
sure.
question, right? But you can manufacture some luck to put yourself in better positions, and eventually there could be an opportunity that you created for yourself because you've made all the mistakes and you're missing all your teeth.
I would say when it ultimately comes together, like, it is luck. Oh, there is luck involved. Like, but you have to continually put the work in to then have it go your way at least one time, I would say there's a lot of bulls that are in range that you don't actually get to release an arrow on. And it kind of, you have to consistently do it over and over and over until finally that one is like, okay, he's going to give you the perfect shot, and you execute and everything goes your way. And I don't know, I think every elk hunt I ever go on, I always think, like, this thing I'm trying to, at some point during the hunt, even though that I know it's not true, I always think this thing I'm trying to do here is impossible. Like, it's literally impossible.
Every hunt.
I always think that. I'm like, this is never going to happen. And then you just maintain, stick with it. Even though in the back of my head, I know that I've done it before and that I'll do it again. You just keep at it, keep at it. But there are definitely some times where you think, man, this thing is impossible. But it isn't. I tell people that all the time. It'll seem impossible, but it isn't. I mean, if I can do it, anybody can.
I feel you.
Yeah. Anyway, I've had you for an hour and a half, Dan. I had so many more questions I wanted to ask you. I'll probably have to ask you some other time. We can just sit around and hang out and just kind of pick your brain. But I really appreciate your time. I appreciate you jumping on. I think you do a really good job of inspiring people. And it sounds funny to say it, but I'm, because I'm in the industry as well, you know what I mean? And I do podcasts and I do content and all that, but I do look up to you and what you're doing. I think you put in an immense amount of time and effort into being the best that you can. So I wanted to shout you out and say, I think you do a really phenomenal job, and you even inspire me to work harder and try to be better. I see you shooting, I see you working out, and I'm not always replicating that, but I'm trying. And so I would say, keep at it, keep doing what you're doing, because it does make a difference to, you know, people out there in a real way. So, with that, I appreciate it. And I hope to run into you, later on in the year, and I hope you have some luck, good luck in the draws, and get a chance to go hunting this fall.
Yeah. Likewise, man. I appreciate you, man. Thanks for having me on. I consider you a peer, and I'm always, always rooting for you, man. So, and if you get a chance, tell Brady, I say what's up, and the whole team over there.
Okay. Thanks, Dan. I appreciate it.